94FM, we start a new book of the week, Discontent and Its Civilizations. Sanjeev Bhaskar reads from the latest collection of essays by Mohsin Hamid, author of The Reluctant Fundamentalist. Written between 2009 and 2011, Mohsin muses on his early years growing up in very different cities.
In December 1980, at the age of 9, I moved back to Pakistan for the first time. We touched down at Lahore in those less security-conscious days when it was still a place where families strolled to the tarmac to greet deplaning passengers. Ronald Reagan had just beaten Jimmy Carter in the election for President of the United States. The Soviet Union was about to mark the first anniversary of its invasion of Afghanistan. Raccoon-eyed General Zia-ul-Haq was ensconced in Islamabad as Pakistan's dictator, and I'd lost my Urdu. It's a funny thing to lose your first language. I was an early talker, chirping along in full sentences and paragraphs well before I turned 2, and I have a scar to prove it. In the summer of 1973, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was campaigning to become Prime Minister of Pakistan, and I picked up the habit of climbing onto the dining table and holding forth in the manner of the speeches I'd heard him make on TV. When I become Prime Minister. One day, someone tried to get hold of me and lower me to the ground. I made a run for it, dashed into thin air, fell, split open my head, and wound up with blood in my eye and stitches across my brow. Bhutto's fate would sadly be similar. The following year, I left Lahore, winging my way via Hong Kong and over the Pacific to San Francisco with my parents. In California, we moved into one of many identical graduate student townhouses on the Stanford University campus. Bands of kids ran around and chased butterflies and dashed through the tish-tish-tishing rotating water sprinklers, all barefoot, unsupervised. I slipped out to join them. My mother heard crying and went to investigate. She saw me in tears at the door next to ours, gazing up at a perplexed neighbor, surrounded by jeering children. My mother took my hand and led me back home. "Is he retarded?" one of my new playmates asked her. "No," she answered. "Then why can't he talk properly?" "He can. He just doesn't know English." After that, I didn't speak for a month. My parents worried, but they decided I probably just needed time to adjust. So they let me sit in front of our TV, do my drawings, and build precariously tall towers with my wooden blocks. And when I next spoke, much to their surprise, it was in English, in complete sentences, and with an American accent. Over the next 6 years, I didn't speak a word of Urdu. I made friends, went for sleepovers, brought home tadpoles and frogs in jam jars, ran like the wind, played soccer, crashed out on unused beds at grad student parties, camped in tents in national parks, asked what that funny smell was at a spliff-heavy open-air Bob Marley concert, swam in the frigid Pacific, dressed in moccasins and beaded vests, and wrote my first stories. Intergalactic space operas inspired by a slew of sci-fi movies and TV shows of the time. Star Wars, Star Trek, Battlestar Galactica, Buck Rogers, Star Blazers, Battle of the Planets. Meanwhile, my dad did his PhD. My mom worked in the accounting department of an early Silicon Valley electronics firm. My little sister was born, and our battered second-hand Datsun clocked tens of thousands of miles. I'd been so fluent in Urdu and such a talker that my parents never realized just how completely I'd forgotten the language until we arrived back in Pakistan. I was thrown into a strange, new, old world of extended families, aunts and uncles, 2 dozen cousins, cricket, odd-tasting bread, still odder-tasting milk, only 1 television channel, and even that on for only part of the day, and an almost complete absence of familiar consumer brands. Here in Lahore, there were no Frosted Flakes, Twinkies, Nestle Quick, Nerf Balls, no More Tears shampoo. On my first day in Pakistan, I asked a cousin, "Are these people slaves?" "No," he explained. "They're servants." I kept wanting to write to my friends in California, but never managed to. What would I even say? Months passed, and then it seemed too late. One night I looked up at the stars and thought, these were the same stars people over there looked up at, and I cried. It was the only time. Pretty melodramatic stuff. But it passed. Or maybe it didn't, but it did subside. Besides, I made new friends, learned new sports, biked around town, found a place that sold model airplane kits, another that sold aquariums and tropical fish, and understood, after the first few bruises, that my cousins were actually like brothers and sisters, a classroom-sized clan always ready to chat and play and come unquestioningly to my defense against the outside world. I liked my new existence, but I liked my old one too, and I imagined places where the two could come together. I was a map buff, and for my 10th birthday, my parents bought me an exquisite atlas. Pencil in hand, I would create new countries, non-existent Pacific islands with snow-topped volcanoes and tightly packed contour lines, the French department of Alpes-Maritimes as an independent republic. I admired its shape. The Katiawa Peninsula, separated from the mainland by a deep canal, a confederacy of mid-sized city-states scattered across a variety of continents. I would write the almanac entries for these places, their histories and natural resources and climates and militaries and flora and fauna. And importantly, their demographics, always mixed, with no clear majority, and with significant immigrant groups of Lahori and San Franciscan descent. This was the creative writing initially inspired by my return to Pakistan. There was also some poetry, modeled on verses in Tolkien and in Bullfinch's mythology. Do you know what a virgin actually is? My dad asked me upon reading it. Like a maiden? I ventured. Most of my family and classmates in Lahore spoke English, so I didn't need to fall silent this time. I just started picking up Urdu on the go. Eventually, I could tell a joke and sing a song in it, flirt and fight, read a story and take an exam. I could speak it without a foreign accent. But my first language would be a second language for me from then on. English fractured for me too, coming in distinct Californian and Pakistani varieties. Later in adulthood, Mid-Atlantic and British English would be added to my mix. Sometimes as a 9-year-old, twice transported, the words I heard moved me in unexpected ways, like impressions of half-forgotten sunny afternoons, less than memories and therefore impossible to share. I wonder now if that is partly why I write. To try. Looking back, art was as important as language in my life. It's obvious to me now that the Pakistan of my teens was bursting with art. I had a burly cousin who used to play incongruously with inks and watercolors in the afternoons when he got home from school. I had an aunt who was in the habit of telling over and over again the story of her random encounter with the famous artist Sadegin, an encounter that resulted in him executing what was surely his version of an autograph, a quick drawing depicting my aunt as a Nefertiti-necked goddess holding a flower above a line of calligraphy. I had seen the legendary painter Chugtai's long-eyed ladies smiling out from the drawing room walls, offering half-lidded innuendos to easily flustered young men like me. And I had in the backdrop of my youth the Lahore Museum, the marvelous old city, the trucks and cinema billboards covered in bold, pelvis-thrusting iconography. But at the time, art felt to me like something that belonged either to the past or to other places, because my teens were in the 1980s, and Pakistan in the 1980s had the misfortune of being governed by a mustachioed dictator with dark bags under his eyes and a fondness for dystopian social re-engineering. General Zia claimed to be acting in the name of Islam, and even though the history of Islam in our part of the world stretched back over 1,000 years, we were told that our Islam wasn't Islamic enough. Indeed, that we Muslims weren't Muslim enough, and that he would make our Pakistan the land of the pure that its name suggested, or ruin us all trying. Under Zia, flogging, amputation, and stoning to death became statutory punishments. Acts disrespectful to symbols of Islam were criminalized. Public performances of dance by women were banned. News in Arabic, the language of the Quran, but spoken by virtually no one in Pakistan, was given a prime-time slot on television. Thugs belonging to the student wings of religious parties seized control of many college campuses. Heroin and assault rifles flooded the streets. Blowback from Pakistan's alliance with the United States against the Soviets in Afghanistan. My parents reminisced about how much more liberal Lahore had been in their youth. When General Zia was blown to bits shortly after my 17th birthday in 1988, he wasn't mourned, at least not by anyone I knew. I left for college in the United States a year later. There I met people who were studying photography and sculpture, and I myself enrolled in classes on creative writing. Without thinking about it, I supposed an education in these artistic pursuits was something in which only affluent societies in the West could afford to invest, or rather, that only the twin luxuries of material success and tolerance of free expression could provide the sort of soil in which an artistic education could thrive. I was, of course, completely wrong. When I returned to Pakistan in 1993, I was working on what would become my first novel. I thought of writing as a transgressive act. I wrote at night, often from midnight to dawn, and in between writing sessions, I would escape into the darkness with my friends. We drove around town in old Japanese cars, hung out on our rooftops, and searched for places beyond the reach of societal control or parental observation. Cheap local booze and even cheaper slabs of hash were the intoxicants of choice in that young urban scene. And avoiding the predations of the bribe-taking police was an alarming and amusing preoccupation. Increasingly, I found my wanderings taking me into the world of the National College of Arts. A couple of my friends were enrolled there, one studying architecture, another graphic design. Others were dating students, painters, printmakers. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen. Students of all social classes and from all parts of Pakistan attended NCA. The place was a microcosm of Pakistan, but of a creative Pakistan, an alternative to the desiccated Pakistan General Zia had tried to ram down our throats. Here, people who prayed five times a day and people who escaped from their hostels late at night to disappear on sexual adventures in the city could coexist. In the studios, I saw calligraphy and nudes, worked by students with purely formal concerns and by others for whom art overlapped with politics. I was inspired. I wrote like crazy. I made friends I've kept for life. Love comes to mind when I think of that time. There was a lot of it going on among the people I hung out with. But I was also falling in love with Pakistan. I've always had a stubborn affection for the land of my birth. When I went abroad for college, I thought I knew it pretty well. But it was my encounters with the denizens of the NCA universe after my return that reminded me that Pakistan is too vast a country to be known, that it is full of surprises, of kinks and twists, of unexpected titillations and empathic connections, of a diversity that can only be described as human. It was exciting and vital and real. Or rather, they were exciting and vital and real, for my Pakistan had become plural. Just a few months ago, I was in Amsterdam with two old friends from the Lahore art world. On a warm summer night, we checked out some galleries and walked along the canals, whirring bicycles and shrooming teenagers passing us in the darkness. Nothing could have been more different from where we had all been 15 years earlier, and nothing could have been more similar.
Sanjeev Bhaskar was reading from Discontent and Its Civilizations by Mohsin Hamid. The book was abridged by Eileen Horn and produced by Clive Brill. It's a Brill production for BBC Radio 4.
Your world. It's full of the things that are important to you.
The main reason the hospital's full to bursting is that so many more of us are living longer, getting more poorly, suffering complex problems, and taking longer here to recover.
From what's plain to see to what's beneath the surface.
Now, this is one area which has been highlighted as being a drug hotspot, and it was.
The more you know about your world, the closer you feel to it.
There's a commercial oven and a table that have drifted past us on this water. They've come out of the ruptured cafe down here.
Your local news matters on BBC Local Radio, TV and online.